This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Given a riveting preview of upcoming lectures, but tonight we have Brandon Unruh, who is a good friend of ours from church. He is a psychiatrist who works at McLean Hospital. He's also affiliated with Harvard Medical School. His specialty is in borderline personality disorder, but also engages with all kinds of different areas in psychiatry. We've had him lecture a couple times here, which has been a real pleasure and an honor to have him. This topic tonight is one that we think about periodically at Libri as being quite a common criticism of people of faith. And so I'm just fascinated to hear what you have to say. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Ben.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, my apologies to everyone for being late. It really is bad form when a psychiatrist opens the door and however many minutes late that I am. It's bad form. So I'm particularly self-conscious of starting late with you all. So my sympathetic nervous system will settle as we get into this, and I appreciate you waiting. And I would say that every time I'm invited to be here at Libri, it's very good to be back at Libri. And every time this statement is true. But I think it feels especially like a shelter tonight with what I just came from at the hospital and just on a snowy night like this. And then driving on the pike the whole time behind the salt trucks. The semi-trucks all the way from Boston. So I should have probably found another route, but I was too desirous of the straight line to get here. So in contrast to the winter cold outside, I'm here tonight to talk about something hot. And that is desire. It works especially well when the sound is so low, right? It really gets the desire going when you can barely hear it. My sound controls disappeared, so I can't turn it up. But I think you get the point. I think you get the point. Oh, no problem. So this Christianity thing, I mean, this is, as Ben said, kind of a Libri light topic, maybe, because I assume it's something that probably everyone in here has thought about from one angle or another. But I would just start by saying this Christianity thing that all in the room, I think, have come to either visit Libri for or work at Libri for, or have been thinking about or reading about or singing about, maybe believing, maybe doubting, perhaps both at the same time, this Christianity thing. Isn't it really just wish fulfillment? It's a persuasive argument. Isn't it an overblown, misplaced glamorization of something as simply and purely human in origin as other bodily functions? Isn't it about time we wake up and see that a belief in God is ultimately based on a mere desire or wish that is just as ephemeral, just as hot-blooded a biological experience as our desire for food, for drink, for sex? Just like we heard in the song, desire. Isn't it an illusory consolation for the weak-willed among us who don't have the guts to face up to life on factual terms? He asks rhetorically. As a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist who spends hours a day listening to people's innermost experiences, desires and wishes have become very curious things for me. I've come to consider them revealing windows that tell more about the state of someone's heart than perhaps anything that a person can verbally express, can say about themselves. We lead with our hearts, not our heads. We are more fundamentally driven by what we desire than by what we think. So I want to know more than anything what my patients love, desire, wish for, more than I ever want simply to know what they think or what they believe or even say. I've learned to view desire as a deep signpost, indicating something important about who my patients really are, what they're really like on the inside. But most of us over the course of our lives, naturally and rightfully, come to view our own experiences of wishing and desiring as imperfect guides, not as thoroughly trustworthy signposts to reality. On the one hand, we know what it's like to feel a desire simply must be indulged, like in the U2 song that we just heard again, the fever getting higher that we barely heard. The fever getting higher fails to make the point. On the other hand, we have this deep sense that desire has an illusory quality, that it can fade over time, and that it's not to be trusted, not to be followed. And yet there's a curious sadness that we can feel about its diminishment in our lives. We also learn that desire can be flat-out deceptive and dangerous, making us wary to trust it out of a fear of following it down harmful paths. And it is often our deepest desires that we may come to mistrust the most. Even as children, we come to associate the things we most sorely wish for with untruth and illusion. You wish. This phrase I heard a lot on the playground as a child in response to my friends and I talking grandiosely about our future hopes and dreams. And every time one of us would share a plan to become a mega celebrity athlete or a rock star, there would come again the disillusioning refrain, "You wish." And sure enough, let's just say that my short-lived chapters in sports and rock music would best remain untold chapters in the histories of those pursuits. So it's easy to hold a low view of desire when we consider all the superficial desires that seem so predictably and contingently shaped by our environments, by our immediate environments, like what immerses our senses. Like me wanting to be a rock star as a kid because I saw rock stars on MTV getting all the attention, living the life. Or wanting to have a lightsaber because I watched the original trilogy countless times as a child. But what about the deeper desires that seem inescapable, that seem a little more deeply embedded within us, not so easily shrugged off as we move through the years? Well, which desires are we talking about here? Well, the precise objects and nature of this desire, not easy to define. But the desire itself seems to be familiar to people of many different worldviews. Consider, as an example, two great intellectuals. Do we still have it? Yeah, we're good. Okay. Consider two great intellectuals who had very different views on the nature of traditional religion. Mark Twain and C.S. Lewis, famously associated with discussions of desire. You probably can't read this, so I'll just read a portion of it to you. So Mark Twain on spring fever, in a short story involving Tom Sawyer. The narrator says, "And when you've got it, you want. Oh, you don't quite know what it is you do want, but it just fairly makes your heart ache. You want it so." He's just talking about spring fever. C.S. Lewis on Sehnsucht, different word for desire, which is sort of spoken frequently here at Labrie. This is from Surprised by Joy. This is the first recounting of the memory of a memory, as he puts it. This is a memory about his brother and the way they used to play together. I'll just read it. It says, As I stood beside a flowering currant bush on a summer day, there arose suddenly in me, without warning, and as if from a depth not of years but of centuries, the memory of that earlier morning at the old house when my brother had brought his toy garden into the nursery. It is difficult to find words strong enough for the sensation which came over me. It was a sensation, of course, of desire, but desire for what? Not certainly for a biscuit tin filled with moss, not for the thing itself. Not even, though that came into it for my own past, not just for the memory. And before I knew what I desired, the desire itself was gone. It's fleeting. The whole glimpse withdrawn. The world turned commonplace again, or only stirred by a longing for the longing that had just ceased. It had taken only a moment of time. And in a certain sense, everything else that had ever happened to me was insignificant in comparison. Have you had that kind of experience? Lewis again. I'm trying to rip open the inconsolable secret in each one of you. The secret which hurts so much that you take your revenge on it by calling it various things to disenchant it, disillusion it, demystify it. The secret also which pierces with such sweetness that when in very intimate conversation, the mere mention of it becomes imminent. We grow awkward and we affect to laugh at ourselves. It's the secret we cannot hide and we cannot tell, though we desire to do both, to express it, to search for it, to put words on it. We cannot tell it because it is a desire for something that has never actually appeared in our experience. We cannot hide it because our experience is constantly suggesting it. I'm not just going to read C.S. Lewis quotes for the whole talk. But consider the sort of desire being described here. Desire for something you can't precisely specify. We find beneath the many more obvious desires that we have, we seem to find this one, or many of us seem to find this one that we can't quite name the object of. We could call it the desire for transcendence, or the desire for perfection. It seems to be, in its various forms, a hope of finding, or meeting, or seeing, or being unified with some really objectively existing thing that is truly perfect, that's totally moral, that's totally loving, just, the good, the true, and the beautiful. And the name that's often given for that is God. But we're not starting with a concept of God, with all the ways that we've learned to think about the concept of God. One of the most interesting things about this experience of desire is the experience itself, which comes to us as this longing with some mysterious properties. So for one thing, we have this desire most not when we're miserable or when we're in a dire crisis or need, but when we're the happiest, when we experience something incredibly beautiful, like falling in love, seeing a newborn baby, or an arresting work of art. And the desire seems to be a pointing finger, in Peter Kreif's words, gesturing beyond the current experience to a future potential extension, or a deepening, or an idealization of what we are currently experiencing, some ideal form of the thing we only now experience a portion of. It's like the smell of a delicious dinner we haven't quite eaten yet. So our mind or our hearts, or at least for a moment, are led to follow that experience. And then we interpret that what we're desiring is something we haven't yet experienced or we aren't fully experiencing. Something that is suggested but not proved by the smaller fulfillments, the incremental experiences of more minor desires that we experience along the way. So I would ask you all to just pause for a moment, as you are doing here at Libri in a much larger way. Pause and just have a think to yourself for a moment. Do you, and if so, how do you recognize this sort of desire within yourself? If not, then now, at the risk of going where words will inevitably fail, I'm going to go a bit further to try to describe components of this transcendental desire for perfection. So here are what I think are three subcomponents, or slightly smaller threads, within the larger desire that I'm trying to speak about. So the first, we could say, is a desire to transcend self. A longing for us, our lives to mean something, to be meant for something, or to be of some grander value than our own design. Some would say it's the desire to live within a story that we're not the authors of, to go on a quest, to be a protagonist in a story we didn't make up. But that vision is not attractive to everyone, which I'll come back to in a bit later. Another maybe thread that we can distill out from this sense of transcendental desire is a desire to transcend space and time. A longing to go on, to exist forever. Again, which not everyone will say they want. We'll come back to that. But a longing to go on forever in infinite union with the perfect, good, true, and beautiful. For our lives to be lifted out of finiteness, out of time. To not come to a finite end. And then thirdly, the desire to transcend what Christians might call sin. A longing for innocence, to become innocent again at the far end of experience. As Blake and you two both like to say. Longing to be forgiven, to be made whole, to be wholly loved. I think that one's a little more experience near, maybe, in our relationships. So, do you recognize any aspects of that within yourself? So just to push a bit further on this, since the nature of this desire is, again, that words fail to adequately describe it, no matter how many you put on it, I'm going to play for you three clips which, for me, subjectively, kindle this desire. And this is purely subjective. So you may see and hear these three clips and have them completely fall flat. And if that's the case, as I play these clips, I invite you to ponder where you might have been attuned to this kind of desire elsewhere, within the films, sounds, the images, relationships, people, places that you've experienced. So I'm going to try this time to turn the sound up a bit, and we'll see if maybe...
I think if you do the output of this, though, because it's on HDMI,
so yeah.
Play through this unless you go...
I could just pop this out and increase the sound on my laptop, right?
Because it's playing out with the projector.
Yeah.
So
can I just pop this out for a minute and then turn up the volume, and will that work?
Yeah, then I'll just play off your laptop. Yeah.
Oh, and then, but then pop it back in.
Yeah, I'm not sure what he has to do to actually get it.
I think if you go to settings and your sound output, if you put it into that, it'll go through there and not. Then it'll play through the sound system over here and not through the projector.
This is just to stoke the desire a little more, just to get you ready. Can I just pop this out and then turn up my computer?
Well, if we can get it coming out of the speakers, it would be better. Let's just give it one try.
Oh, wow.
Now we're really hyping it.
I'm just going to... Oh.
That's okay. Fine. Yeah.
And then if we go to your set, you might go to your set.
Oh, yeah. Let's see that. I
just do like search bar.
I can't even do that because it's got me going through this, right?
If you do like audio, audio source, if you just type that into like your.
I have such an old operating system on this laptop.
I'm just going to try popping this out.
Can we just do that? Yeah. Let's try that. All right. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. We'll just turn it up a little bit and hope it does. No problem. All right, so can we... Is this one come back, probably?
Yes.
Okay. All right, we'll just give it a go. All right.
Come on.
All right, so naturally. Lord of the Rings, right? So this is just a little clip, desire to trans-self, that longing to be part of a story, for our lives to have some purpose, to find ourselves in some larger context. Oh, dear.
It's still coming out of the projector.
Oh, it's so quiet. Well, I can pause it there because you probably can't hear it, but... people probably familiar with this clip where Frodo's sort of discovering vis-a-vis Gandalf that he's part of a larger story. There are forces at work that are grander than he's aware, and he's waking up into that. I wonder if just playing it off my laptop might be better.
Yeah, just play it off. Yeah.
Sorry, everyone. Oh, but wait a minute. That's going to...
So leave that plugged in and I'll just take the audio cable out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But I think it's still going to play through here because this is...
Does that go through there?
Yeah. Okay. I can look really quick. I'm so sorry.
Okay. Oh, no problem. No, it's my own fault for being... Well, having enough time to go through it. Thanks, Joshua.
Well, I haven't done anything yet.
Oh, that's better. Well, you did something.
But we lost the image.
Oh. How do I
how do you get out of?
Yeah, I know. I don't. It's in a weird sort of.
Okay, here we go. Yeah. Talk amongst yourselves again.
Yeah. Can we get the dancing bear back on the stage?
All right, sound. And then, yeah, headphones.
Do we have to put that in? And then, thanks, Josh.
This is totally going to work.
It's totally.
Thank you, Joshua.
Oh, yes, that looks promising.
Okay.
Display port?
Yeah, I think that's going
to... have to go
the
to
headphone
this.
Port. Okay. I don't think, because then...
Wanted on the headphone port.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's try this
go
one.
Back to this. Okay, that's fine.
Go for it.
Yeah, okay. All right. Okay. Fingers crossed. All right.
Let's see. New slideshow.
All right. So desire to transcend space and time. So this longing to go on forever. This is another famous scene, of course. Let's hopefully this won't destroy people's eardrums, I hope. It's too much. I'll go to just the dialogue. The end? Is it the end?
Death is just another path. One that we almost take. The grey rain curtain of this world rolls back and all turns to silver glass. And then you see it.
And now. See what?
White shores. And beyond. A far green country. And of a swift sunrise.
And I'm so bad.
Stop before the booming comes back again and destroys. So the real Lord of the Rings fans in the room know that this is dialogue not from the scene in the books, but lifted from, sort of borrowed from the Grey Havens. But it's the same idea. The Grey Curtain rolls back and there's something more good, true, and beautiful at the end of the story. And then this desire to transcend sin, this longing to become innocent again. So this is a deep cut from the early U2 Voix, and I'll just play a portion of it. The song is called Scarlet, and the scriptural reference is here in front of you. A single lyric. Stop it just for the sake of, I don't want to destroy people's hearing.
I turned it down a little bit. Do you want
to? That's all right. They got a taste. Okay. I'll keep going, and this may come back later. So, what do we make of this? Do you recognize any aspects of this desire within yourself now? Well, where, if anywhere, do you feel any aspects of this desire for transcendence or perfection? Maybe not there, in those three places. But if you recognize any intimations of this desire, which most people would say they do, the next questions are, well, what best explains the existence and the unshakable pull of this desire? And what should become of it? What are the courses it can travel across our lives? Let's consider four potential paths that this desire can travel. its desire for perfection? Well, first, the desire itself can become wrongly deified. And what I mean by that is that our desire for the infinite can become misdirected towards finite objects. We mistake lower, finite desires for the higher, infinite one. And we tend to imbue them with an ultimacy and an urgency that they were never intended to carry. Thus, we tend to seek or even expect or demand the concrete indulgence of these desires, where such a thing will either not be possible or will not be ultimately edifying. We might arrive at the false conclusion that anything we have ever come to desire with such urgency and ultimacy, it must be good for us. But over time, we find this higher key melody of a transcendent desire coming back in, but we realize it's sadly, it's not transposable into a lower key. We're left stumbling after desires that come to be addictive or leave us feeling debased or emptied out rather than nourished, yet still strangely wanting more. And that's a clinical distinction I make as a psychiatrist quite often. As just one example, common in my work, a longing to be loved perfectly by a perfect object, for many, can become a demand to be loved unconditionally and perfectly by fellow human beings who are incapable of such a thing. So the clinical work, when someone presents with that kind of a misdirected desire, is to help someone come to accept the reality that other human beings may provide some consolation and comfort and love in this life, but they will not provide a perfect loving relationship. Some examples from literature here on the screen include Gollum, whose desire for little precious. Little precious. We'll get the gargle. The desire for the ring that he lost to Bilbo Baggins becomes all-consuming, addictive. The desire is initially at war with other, more transcendental desires in Smeagol. Like to be in friendly fellowship with Frodo and Sam. The desire for affiliation, beautifully depicted in the movie. But it becomes all-consuming and misdirected, and it ultimately destroys him. His misplaced infinite desire for a finite thing literally plunges him into the fires of Mount Doom. A second literary example is the picture of Dorian Gray. How many here have read it? A few, several? Yeah, one of my favorite novels. I won't recap the whole story. It's a lot of spoilers, but essentially it's about a story of sort of an aristocrat who meets another aristocrat, an artist who sort of invites him into a world of pursuing sensual desire. He becomes a total sensualist, and he trades any sense of any pursuit of moral virtue for this hedonism. And it's just I won't say more. I really don't want to spoil it, but it's a brilliant depiction about desire misdirected. And a third example. Anybody know the reference? The third one here? Anybody know it? Shout it out if you know it. It's a play. Well, that's Harry Potter, yeah. If anybody doesn't recognize it. But that's not what it's taken from. That's not the film. Equus. Right. So this is one of probably my favorite play. Peter Schaffer's Equus, which tells the story of how transcendent desire and the lack of it can destabilize one's foundations at the core. It's the story of a burned-out middle-aged psychiatrist. I think I'm only two of those three things. Dr. Dysart, formerly one of the best at his craft, called on to treat a 17-year-old boy, Alan Strang, who's done a bizarre thing. He seems to have gouged out the eyes of six horses with a spike in a fit of frenzied desire, and no one knows why. So Dr. Dysart has decided for himself that no God exists, but as he explores his patient's troubled mind, he comes to envy the boy, Alan, who has made up a horse religion with strong echoes of Christianity. Dr. Dysart is tasked with treating the boy and eliminating this desire, but after coming to understand the boy's devotion to the horse god, he professes that he's ambivalent about removing the boy's belief, because he cannot think of, quote, anything worse one can do to anybody than take away their worship. Dysart sees that the death of real worshipful desire spells the death of a certain kind of humanity itself. And at the end of the play, spoiler, minor spoiler, Dysart is staring alone out into the audience, into the darkness of the theater, mourning that the treatment he has undertaken will turn Alan into a ghost, and they will both be left with no way of seeing in the dark. And the play serves up this haunting question of whether there's something about Alan's transcendent desire which has gone wrong and should be treated as pathology and removed, or should instead be emulated. So I would say that in all these examples, the transcendent desire has become deified and wrongly attributed to unworthy objects, while the true object is being missed. And C.S. Lewis responds well to this concern. He says, "The objects in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them. It was not in them, it only came through them, and what came through them was the longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire, but if they're mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, a horse god, a ring, hedonism, sensual pleasure, breaking the hearts of their worshippers. For they're not the thing itself, they're only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we've never yet visited." Been a few tunes we have not heard fully tonight. So let's consider a second course for this transcendent desire. If the first is that it can become deified through misdirection, let's consider a second natural path that this desire can take in human experience. That is that the desire can lie dormant or be diminished. It may seem to have either died in us or never really grown within us. And this is to say that the desire has become deadened or exists with us, within us, in an unrecognized or deadened state. I think Pink Floyd's perennial dorm room classic, Comfortably Numb, captures this sense well. I remember my experience with this song for the first time, but the lyrics are on the right, and I'll just play a brief clip. Listening to that together, if you identify as someone who does not have this transcendent desire that we've been speaking of, it's worth considering why we find that to be such a beautiful song. It is certainly beautiful, but it is mournful. The lyricist seems not pleased to report on the state of his deadened desire. His is portrayed as a tragic fate. It's the combination of the heroism of David Gilmour at the top of the wall, right? This incredibly grandiose guitar solo with this mourning, the death of desire. Is there not something of the transcendent desire itself contained within that mournful recognition? Just like when desire becomes deified and we come to our senses later only to mourn that we've latched our highest desires to unworthy objects, here we seem to mourn the deadening of our desire through mechanisms we may not understand so well. As many who are unpersuaded to believe in God have said, people say, "I wish I could believe in a God like the one you've described, but I just can't, or I don't want to. I wouldn't want that kind of transcendence." And there seems to be something mournful when I hear comments like that, if they're meant genuinely. Not for everyone. Now, of course, some will say, Brandon, I truly don't want this kind of transcendent perfection. I have no desire for perfection at all. I have made myself contented with the realization that this world does not offer such perfection. I'm awake to that. I'm truly fine with knowing that the perfect sunsets I enjoy, the pangs of desire I feel for another person, these don't point to any more perfect version of what I'm already experiencing. I'm content to say this is all I've got. Why aren't these time-limited, short-lived satisfactions of more humble, ordinary, non-transcendent desires, why isn't that enough? Well, my first response would be to concede that these experiences are indeed not conclusive proofs that any transcendent object exists. I think the argument I'm slowly trying to lay out in this talk cannot compel, it can only appeal. Appeal to what? I think it might appeal to the vault of human experience through the ages. For me, as a psychotherapist sitting with people discussing their innermost experiences and desires, it appeals to me. And it may appeal to your own private searchings of your own heart. My second response is a little more provocative and comes from my experience, again, as a psychiatrist and as a therapist working intensively with people over multiple years to explore aspects of their mind not so immediately knowable by them. It's a basic teaching of Freud, who you've been wondering, when will he show up in this talk? He's coming. We'll come to him in a moment, and it's a basic teaching not just of Freud, but many of his descendants, as well as contemporary current psychologists, psychiatrists, as well as neuroscientists, that our own minds are inevitably black boxes unto ourselves. We cannot fully know the contents or processes within our own minds, let alone the minds of others. We cannot comprehensively observe the workings of our own mind with objectivity. There's always an observer effect. Not only do we know that we can't fully know ourselves at any one moment, we also know a great deal about how biological and environmental interpersonal forces shape the ways in which the connections to certain parts of our minds can become deadened or disconnected over time. And I can say a lot more about that in Q&A if people are interested, about how do we think any of our desires for anything become deadened over time. But this would mean that my experiences of human others, my early attachment experiences, the traumas that I've endured, whether acute single incident traumas or repeated, continuous, relational traumas, that all of those experiences may directly impact my conscious imaginative connection to anything transcendent. So to make this a little more concrete, our adult beliefs about God often begin in our childhood experiences of our key attachment figures early in life. And it begins in the trustworthiness or non-trustworthiness of what they teach or do not teach us about authority, about whether desires in general have objects out in the world, about the concept of God. And as we grow up and decide what to do for ourselves with the concept of God, our evolving sense of a transcendent figure who's either present or absent in our imagination, or what to make of the attraction or the repulsion that we might feel to the notion of a God, all of this becomes an attachment relationship like any other. It's a template in our minds. It's very much contingent on concrete human experiences. I would suggest that each of us develops an evolving attachment relationship to the concept of God, whether we perceive God as real or imagined. It's a relationship in every sense, shaped by the whole range of early life events, dynamic conscious and unconscious forces, and attachment processes. As an example, consider what one of my patients said about how she came to believe God does not exist. This is someone who had a highly traumatic early childhood. That's just a horror story. And at one point in telling me about some of the most horrible details, she abruptly paused and looked up and said, That's the moment when I stop believing in God. My parents still believe in him, but how could I, given what I just told you, happened to me? It would be insanity to believe that after what I've been through. And I give that example only to suggest that it's possible to come to a place of deadened or abandoned or disconnected desire for the transcendent through normal developmental and psychological pathways that we understand something about empirically. Similarly, I have seen it's possible for a desire for the transcendent to reawaken over time with effort, with deepening experiences in life, and with enhanced attention to one's own deeper or more integrated self. Again, I'll leave this. We can talk further about this in the Q&A if people are interested in more technical points about this. But suffice it to say, as I go on to the next point, that like all other elements of conscious mental life, the degree to which we experience or don't experience this desire for transcendence and perfection, that is itself heavily shaped by the slings and arrows that we encounter in our lives. Ironically, another way to put this is to say that a death of desire within our conscious awareness is not necessarily the end of that desire. Transcendent desire, by definition, itself can die and come back to life. My own desire as a Christian for God ebbs and flows. It dies and it is then resurrected all the time. And sometimes we have to go on living in darkness for a while to bear witness to the rebirth of that desire within ourselves. But now we come to a third pathway, more Pink Floyd. A third course that this transcendent desire can take. Another way of understanding why do so many people seem to have this experience and what should we make of it. And here we finally come to Freud and one of his predecessors, Feuerbach, and a serious argument for the you-wish-driven skepticism that I started with. This you-wish-driven skepticism prevails in our culture today as a serious argument against belief in anything transcendent, not just God. Many today would say that they don't want to believe in God, but that those who do are driven to do so as a kind of wish fulfillment. This you wish argument against God has many proponents from an esteemed lineage of heavyweight intellectual figures: Voltaire, Diderot, Darwin, Feuerbach, one of my favorites. But it was most popularized and sharpened by Sigmund Freud as part of his rather sustained and systematic attack on the religious worldview. Freud referred to religion as the universal obsessional neurosis of humanity, and he claimed that the spiritual worldview distorts the picture of the real world in a delusional manner. And the main data that Freud brought in support of this position was that he observed powerful wishes and needs beginning inside us as children. That's undebatable. Which only seem transcendent, but in reality point to nothing outside of human subjectivity. He writes in The Future of an Illusion that we shall tell ourselves it would be very nice if there was a God who created the world and was a benevolent providence, and if there was a moral order in the universe and the afterlife. But it is a very striking fact that all this is exactly as we are bound to wish it to be. It's just what we wish for. How convenient. He traces the derivation of religious needs back to the longing for a protective father that's aroused in all of us when we're helpless as infants. It's undeniable that that's there. We become adults, but we still find ourselves just as helpless existentially, spiritually, just as unprotected when we're confronted with the great forces of life and death. So we conjure up a figure like the one who protected us as a child, or the one we wish had protected us as a child, so we can go on tolerating life. Freud therefore concludes that belief in a personal God is merely psychologically nothing other than an exalted father, a fulfillment of the oldest, strongest, and most urgent wishes of mankind. The bottom line is that God does not create us in his image. We create God in our image, in the image of the parents that we once had or longed to have had. It's a powerful argument. So I want to highlight two helpful aspects, two strengths of this argument, this wish fulfillment position. First, it cuts against the postmodern myth that reality is determined by subjectivity. Freud is right that our wishes do not determine physical reality. He was not a postmodernist in that sense. The modern band Radiohead, whom I do not have a clip to play, sums up this position nicely in their song, There, There, with the lyric, "Just 'cause you feel it doesn't mean it's there." In my line of work, when someone comes to me seemingly believing something is true, just because they feel it to be, we diagnose this as a psychological problem. It can become a real problem when a person's everyday interactions with others become charged with a subjective significance and sense of meaning in the mind of one person that just isn't there in the minds of others around that person. Those are my patients, to some degree. So the wish fulfillment objection is right to remind us our feelings about our deeply held beliefs or experiences do not make them true. And there's a second crucial psychological truth conveyed by this wish fulfillment objection, namely that our beliefs are generally prone to error and distortion based on emotional factors, including but not limited to desires and wishes. So we could say that although wishes do not determine physical reality, they are themselves powerful arbiters of mental reality. Any psychologist or psychiatrist or therapist knows this, and we learn to recognize denial and projection as symptoms of unconscious or unmetabolized, unrecognized wishes and desires for things to be or not be a certain way. So we get familiar with this way in which emotional factors color beliefs. We train our ears to hear these symptoms the way a physical doctor learns to hear a heart murmur as symptoms of a valve dysfunction. This is important for psychological well-being because we're all vulnerable to believing things not strictly based on logic. In fact, most of what we come to, I would argue, we come to not deductively through our powers of reasoning, but inductively by appraising the authority and the trustworthiness of that, the source of the knowledge, the teachers, the books that we read, the teachers who've taught us, the music we listen to. Recent research on how we learn as children, the most basic beliefs that shape the course of our lives suggest that we are most likely to take in what we're taught when we appraise that the one teaching us is trustworthy and is speaking to us with great personal interest in who we are as an individual. But that process is completely independent from the truth value of what is being taught, one could argue. So think of cults. You can have that powerful process of social cognition and transaction, transmission of cultural knowledge intergenerationally, and just because you feel it doesn't mean it's there. Just because you've learned it from a trustworthy attachment figure doesn't mean it's true. So the wish fulfillment objection is very right to underscore the potential for believing falsehoods when emotions are allowed to guide reason, rather than the other way around. It is crucial to be aware, as much as we can, of the historical and psychological influences on what we come to believe. But now I want to flip to the other side and submit to you that there are two deep problems with the wish fulfillment argument against the religious worldview. So here's the first fatal flaw. If the wish fulfillment argument is a valid objection to theism, it seems equally valid to apply it in the opposite direction, to explain away atheism, because atheism can be just as psychologically motivated as theism. C.S. Lewis again wrote that belief in the Christian God involves a great deal of despair and pain, actually, and it is certainly not, at least on the face of it, not something one would wish for once you appreciate the nuance of what's being talked about. He notes the Christian worldview begins with the realization that we're in deep trouble, not just because the world is bad, but because we are bad. We have transgressed God's moral law and need forgiveness and reconciliation and restoration. Lewis wrote that although the Christian faith can be a thing of unspeakable comfort, it does not begin in comfort, it begins in dismay. So Christianity, on closer inspection, doesn't actually seem like the kind of thing that is purely wished for. Rather, it is often powerfully wished against. And in Freud's own case, entire books have been written on his own potential psychological motivation against religious belief, and I'm sure this has been talked about over the generations here at LaBrie. Many have argued that Freud's disbelief might have been psychologically motivated and grounded in his experience of disappointment with his earthly father. One can tell a story, and many have written book-length stories. You could say they're just so stories, but you can make that claim in any of these directions. That's the point. But many have written how, as an adult, Freud wrote about discovering intense feelings of envy and rivalry towards his father, but also disgust and disappointment that when little Freud was 10 years old and he heard his father, an Orthodox Jew, refusing to defend himself against anti-Semitic bullies who pushed him into the street off the sidewalk. And one could tell a story in which if Freud associated religious belief with his own father, who became so devalued in Freud's mind, why he might be powerfully motivated to reject belief in a transcendental father, or Father God. So my point is not that that's the correct story to tell about Freud, just that we can tell these kinds of stories in 360 degrees. So if the charge of wish fulfillment can equally be laid at the feet of any worldview, theism, atheism, everything in between, what about all beliefs and worldviews? It would seem to render belief in anything illogical if one has any psychological grounds for wanting that belief to be true. Anything that ever seems desirable to believe in any sense could not be regarded as true. I think that becomes a reductio ad absurdum. The argument is reduced to absurdity when taken to its logical conclusion. We could debate this in the Q&A. Furthermore, when we look at more closely at the wish fulfillment argument, we find it is, I think, logically invalid. So follow me here. If we grant, as the argument would have us accept, that there's a universal or a nearly universal desire for transcendence, God, then the existence of such a desire can become an argument for the object of that desire rather than against it. So let me now take some time to explain this. This is leading up to C.S. Lewis's famous argument from desire, which I imagine many know. But let's start with a piece of experiential data about the desire for perfection, which again, most of us find within our own hearts when we search ourselves with honesty. And as I've said, beneath all the more obvious desires that we have, we find one that we can't completely define the object for. Again, it's a desire for something we can't quite specify. It's a desire which nothing in time, nothing on earth, nothing in any other person or creaturely thing can fully satisfy. It's a desire for what we might just call perfection. A desire that there really be that object that's totally good, beautiful, just, loving, understanding. And the name that many give to that object is God. But if we don't say, with Freud, that this is a universal illusion, or a great hallucination or neurosis, well, we're left to say that what we're desiring is something real, but something that we just haven't yet fully experienced. Lewis said we can interpret this desire by a law that seems to apply to every other desire we find within ourselves. So it's spelled out here as a little bit of a syllogism, the closest you can get to it with this argument. He says, well, we can classify our desires into those which seem artificial and those which seem natural or innate or universal. That's what he means by natural desires, those that seem most universally embedded within Homo sapiens. So artificial desires first. Let's talk about that. Those seem to be stimulated by particular contingent aspects of our environment, such as an advertisement that I saw, or someone suggesting to me that I should believe something or have something. Those artificial desires may or may not correspond to a really existing object. So if, as a child, I wanted to fly through the air like Superman, that doesn't prove that I will ever actually do it. My desire to fly like Superman or travel through time in a DeLorean doesn't prove I will ever do it. I'm still, you can buy a DeLorean these days. I checked this out just the other day. Not as expensive as you might think. But there are these other desires that are natural, innate, that everyone seems to have, that seem to come with human nature itself. The desire for food, for drink, for rest, for sex, for beauty, justice, friendship. And all of those things seem to exist. Every natural desire corresponds to a really existing object which can satisfy that desire. That's the observation he claims to be making. Today we have to think, well, what about, though, if I don't identify a desire for sex, for example, as some don't? So we have to kind of bookmark that and come back to it. But let's just close out the argument here. The idea is that, well, you have a desire for food. You might not get it. You might not get a full belly tonight. You might starve, actually. You might die from that desire not being met. But the universal experience of hunger proves the existence of food somewhere in the world. So now if you mash these two principles together, premise one, premise two, the experience of this apparently natural, universal desire for transcendence, and the observation that every other natural desire we have seems to correspond to a real object, the premises seem to suggest that there somehow, somewhere, under some condition, there is this mysterious perfection or transcendent object. Lewis summarizes the argument this way. He says, if we find ourselves with a desire that nothing in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that we were made for another world. I feel like that should be engraved somewhere here. He called this desire the dominant psychological force in his life, which ultimately led him from atheism to belief in God. And it's the story told in Surprise by Joy. Freud, fascinatingly, recognized a similar desire in himself. He explained it differently. He talked about a longing that haunted him all his life. This is in his letters, which he amazingly described using the same German word Lewis used to describe it, Sehnsucht. Freud associated this desire with a wish to walk in the woods with his father, as he did when he was a child. Isn't that interesting? But let's consider some important objections to this argument, and there are many. The first is to say, well, what if I just don't have this desire? Which would be to claim, this actually is not a universal natural desire. Premise one or whichever it was. Well, we could discuss this a little bit more in the Q&A maybe if people aren't completely asleep by that point. But as a therapist, I would want to sit down with a person who says that and peer back into the past with you to ask whether you have ever had it sometime earlier in your life. And this is just a purely anecdotal experiential point. Take it for what it's worth, maybe not much, but I have never listened to anyone's story in my consulting room in which I did not hear some echo or some distant memory of this desire, however faint. Take that for what you will. We can discuss it. Second counter-argument would be, well, no thanks. I don't want to have this desire. And this objection might be better restated. Well, this is a famous sort of way of putting this. It's better to travel hopefully than to arrive. The notion that it's all about the journey in life, that actually life is more beautiful because there isn't a grand final destination or purpose. And, you know, I won't try to take that apart too much, but I think we can just say, I think it's a kind of self-defeating claim, you know, the hope to set out on a journey and never arrive at it. How can one be hopeful, genuinely, along the way if one is truly convinced that there's no hope of ever arriving? It becomes a kind of, I think, nonsensical category, but we can debate this again. The third objection, and I realize I'm not giving definitive answers to these, I'm just raising these with you, we can discuss. The third would be, well, I've mentioned this before, the position that would say, well, don't we learn as we mature to content ourselves with knowing that just some partial objects of desire exist? So we could say, well, don't we learn that there's just some justice is okay, some friendship is okay, that was a friend for a season, and that was more beautiful than it would have been if it had lasted forever, or, you know, some love is really enough for me. I don't want it to go on forever. But again, experientially to me, listening closely to the nuances of these kinds of claims, it seems to me that we do desire not just a certain quality, but a quantity, and an actually infinite quantity. When a loved one is dying, I've never heard someone and believed them when they've said something like, it's all good with me. I know this is the end of things. I'm contenting myself with this being the end. There is that inescapable longing to have more with the person. It's difficult to imagine how it would be to have these desired things forever, which is another objection. Well, I wouldn't want to be in a heaven with a God like that you describe. But I would suggest these are our failures of imagination rather than logical counterarguments. It is difficult to imagine what it would be to be in the presence of perfect goodness, beauty, and truth forever. But I think we find that we do want the forever. We can, again, debate this. The next objection is to say, well, all other natural desires, I'll grant you that, you know, maybe the existence of thirst proves that there's water, the existence of hunger proves that there's food. All these other natural desires might correspond to existing objects, but not this particular desire. This one is special for reasons that we can't explain, but it is its own special epiphenomenon of the mind with its own special evolutionary adaptive function. Maybe we just can't explain exactly the function completely right now, but this natural desire just doesn't correspond. It's a special case. Well, my answer to that I take from Peter Kraft, who I heard say once in a talk, consider the alternative. And he says, well, it's like going into a fancy French restaurant and go in and you want some nuts to start with, and they bring you some nuts, and then you want some cheese, and they bring you some cheese, and then you want another hors d'oeuvre, and they bring you the hors d'oeuvre, and then you want the main course, and they bring you the platter, and you're ready for the main course, and then the cover is lifted off, and there's nothing. And he says, well, that doesn't seem like a random universe, which is what people who tend to make this counter-argument tend to say they believe in. This is more like a devil's design or a cruel trick. It seems more like a universe with some reverse intentionality, some cruelness in it, rather than randomness. It doesn't sort of hang with the general worldview from which this objection is lobbied from within. The next objection is to say, well, fine, even if I grant this argument, maybe there's this sort of deistic God somewhere, the God of Spinoza, or maybe this doesn't really prove that God has any particular attributes. It doesn't get you very far. And
I would say, well, I would grant, actually. I think that there's something true about that. I would say alone, if we take this argument in a vacuum, it gives us probably just a very thin slice of God. The last counter-argument would be to say, well, this doesn't really prove God because, look, at the, and this is probably the most common, I think, counter-argument. Look, naturalistic explanations of this are adequate. We have perfectly sufficient ways of understanding why human beings would have evolved to have this desire for transcendence. We could think about there, and there are purported explanations of this, and those explanations are more parsimonious because it doesn't bring all this metaphysical baggage of positing a God that we can't see and so on and so forth. It's just easier to believe that this has some adaptive evolutionary function and we don't require a supernatural explanation. So again, here I would grant that this argument is not a proof, but as Kraft says, it's a pointing finger. And I would say that I remain a Christian theist, for many reasons, but when I think about, well, what are the sort of logical reasons that have been most compelling for me? It's not just because of a single argument. It's an accumulation, a summation of arguments and thoughts that in my mind amounts to a preponderance of evidence for God, weighed against some evidence for not God. So it's like a bunch of pointing fingers together becomes a gesturing hand, and two hands gesturing in concordance in the same general direction starts to make out the shape of a whole person who seems to be making a personal invitation to follow. And that is the Christ. That is to say that this argument, when considered along others, I think becomes a beckoning into an experience of relational faith in a person rather than a pure logical syllogism, as it was laid out on the previous slide. So, brief little case study, because a psychiatrist or doctor can't give a talk without a case study. Are we doing okay in terms of stamina and alertness? I think most eyes are open. There'll be some more music at the end, so hang out for that. So, in my clinical work, again, I often have to decide how to respond to what seem to me to be expressions of this desire. So let me tell you about a patient, C, I'll call her. She was a woman in her mid-20s, multiple diagnosed psychiatric disorders, and she was in treatment with me after a nearly lethal suicide attempt. She had tried to kill herself on Valentine's Day after her partner had pulled away, calling her too much, too overwhelming, too emotional, too demanding, too needy. And this experience for my patient of being too much for someone to love had always been unmanageable. Whether she felt this message from her parents, boyfriends, girlfriends, platonic friends, roommates, therapists, her worldview centered on trying to understand herself and her place in the universe through astrology and zodiac signs. But it did not seem to be helping her at this crucial nexus of her search for unconditional love in a concrete, tangible world. And this experience of hers had led to multiple suicide attempts over the years, and it was the central problem targeted in our treatment. Week after week, I sat with her, challenging her to reduce her dependency on others and accept that human relationships cannot be perfectly accepting or validating or forgiving or loving. Wake up! She did very well in our program. She got sober. She got a job. She started living independently again. She even accepted for a while, she voluntarily accepted a need to forgo romantic relationships for a while to try to build herself up. But the problem, if it was a problem, of her longings for an unconditionally loving other, that problem persisted, untouched by our work, resurfacing every time she'd become angry or despondent over the world's inevitable imperfect understanding and care for her. She would get angry and despondent with me because I, as she was quick to point out, very imperfectly understood and cared for her. And that was true. It seemed an unchangeable part of her experience everywhere she went, everywhere she looked, and it kept her prone to suicidal thinking and behavior. Then one day she showed up for a session just weeping. And it took a few minutes to steady herself and tell me what happened. So earlier that day, she'd been at work, struggling. She was always struggling. She'd taken a smoke break, and she went outside in the cold, and she caught the gaze of a man and a little girl standing across the street. This was in Davis Square, looking at her from across the street, and it was odd, and it sort of weirded her out. And as C described this to me through tears, she said, it was like they were looking right into me or through me or something. And then they walked right up to me, and the man said, God loves you. And then again, he just said, God loves you. And then again, God loves you unconditionally, no matter who you are, where you've been, or what you've done. It looked like you needed to hear that from me. And in telling me this, she's looking right up at me and just tears streaming down. She says, Brandon, I started to cry. This was hours ago, and I have not been able to stop crying since. I have no idea why. I don't believe in this stuff. You know I don't believe in this stuff. But right now I feel like I want to. Can it really be true? Why can't I stop crying? What the hell is happening to me? So how was I going to respond as her shrink? How would you respond as a friend? I could say that her longing for an idealized caregiver and God is mere wish fulfillment. That would be the party line in my profession. It's a higher grade of the same problem that she has with her idealization in human relationships. That's a persuasive argument. Or I could invoke the way she was prone to this overly personalized, almost magical thinking, imbuing ordinary, mundane moments for the rest of us with a lot of meaning, looking to the stars for great meaning and interpretations about her life. I could say this is just more of the same. Now she's just doing it with this sort of bizarre interaction she had in the street. Of course she would respond this way. It was such a highly personalized interaction. That itself, it's like the baby learning something that's completely untrue from a trusted attachment figure in a cult. Maybe she would have responded the same way to someone just throwing some change at her, or offering her a drink, or playing a song for her, or just saying hello. Or, third possibility, I could wonder whether this was her mood lability. You know, some loosening of associations or thought process. She did have some bipolarity at the same time, in addition to the other problems that we were working on. Fourth option. I could regard her response as something deeply, essentially human, fueled by that elusively embedded desire for some perfection that I find within my own heart too. Because there is a fourth course that this desire for transcendence and perfection can travel in our lives, in addition to the previous three. And that is, within these moments of inescapable, inexplicable, desiring imagination that we seem to have, it is to be swept away as we allow this desire to deliver us deep into the heart of God, as it's true in perfect objects. My pager seems to agree. The scriptures tell us that this is exactly who the Christian God is. Just a few signposts from scripture, the notion of God as architect, visible everywhere. Romans says, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. That could seem to explain some of the desire in our hearts. What about God as the fulfillment of this desire? Well, Psalm 37 says, delight yourself in the Lord. He will give you the desires of your heart. A bidirectional relationship, taking our delight in God and having more desire returned to us, wanting more rather than the thing being quenched, the longing for more that we have not yet experienced. Psalm 63, O God, you are my God, earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you, my flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. And in John 7, on the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus himself stood up and cried out, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scriptures have said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." So talk about a potential quenching of thirst. One final set of verses. I won't read all of these for time. I know we've gone on here a long time. But this sense of God as both transcendent as immanent. I love this story about the triumphant entry, and people may be familiar with the story. So this is Jesus coming in to Jerusalem, riding on a donkey, fulfilling a prophecy in Zechariah from the Old Testament. And you've got people sitting around sort of watching the lead up to this triumphal entry, and I think probably watching it while it happened. And there's disciples watching, there's the crowd watching, and then there's in verse 19 here the Pharisees watching, sort of the interpreters of the religious law. They say, "Well, you see that you're gaining nothing. Look how the whole world has gone after him." I just love that line. Look how the whole world has gone after him. And I would argue in the context of this talk, the whole world is still going after him. Our deepest transcendent desires are going after him. And as we just read, he promises that he will answer as the faithful and perfect object and person whom we seek. So we're getting close to wrapping up very soon. Let's go back though to the picture of Dorian Gray. So I'll just give you one little spoiler. So at the end of the story, as Dorian Gray, the protagonist, becomes awakened, he comes all the way back around and he's sort of given up, you know, sensual pleasures, but then he learns that even his renunciation of the sensual pleasure, that itself was a vanity and done as a pursuit to achieve something, you know, for the novelty of it, and just a new thing to sort of, a new task to set himself to and surmount. So as he's awakened to sort of the fullness of vanity and evil within himself, coming to the end of himself, he says to this friend Basil, "It's too late for me." And Basil replies, "It's never too late, Dorian. Isn't there a verse somewhere? Though your sins be as scarlet, yet I will make them as white as snow." There's that desire coming in. That's the verse that inspired that song that we couldn't really hear much of, Scarlet. The lyric is "Rejoice." It's just sung over and over and over again. My favorite U2 song, I think. That is a truly beautiful thought that U2 are still playing with, you know, 4 decades later. That when we come to the end of ourselves and face this deeply embedded longing, there we might find not wish fulfillment, but a reliable signpost pointing to not just a God in the abstract, but an imminent Savior. Belief in that God, I would argue, in Jesus, cannot be true simply because it is beautiful and desirable to us, but it can only be beautiful if it is true. We can only really desire it if it is true, if you believe this argument from desire. Jesus claimed to be both. I'm the way and the truth and the life. Like my patient C, and like Freud, and Lewis, and Dorian Gray, we all have to search ourselves for this transcendental desire, and we have to decide what we'll make of it, and which course it's going to take in our lives. And if that desire that we find within ourselves does have this perfect object that's all loving, all true, and wholly good, wouldn't it respond if we call out for it? Well, we can try it and see. We can ask him to reveal himself as the true object of our deepest longings and wishes, and I wager that we will find not a life of wish fulfillment or escapism, but a life marked by the deeper fulfillment that comes from a relationship with the very author of our lives, who sets our hearts on fire with desire, the feverish desire we started with, to love him and be loved by him. So now I will really close. This is like the Lord of the Rings, like multiple endings at the end of Return of the Kings. When's he going to stop? Almost. I want to close with an acknowledgement and a final set of images and sounds that I hope will play. The poet Marc Saint Germain wrote this play imagining a fictional encounter between Freud and Lewis. And I wonder if anybody here has heard of this or seen the play or read the... No.
good, something new for Libri, something you have, some reference you haven't heard of. So this was a fictionalized encounter between Freud and C.S. Lewis. It's tantalizingly entertaining. This was based on a book, The Question of God, written by my old professor, Armin Nicolai, a psychiatrist who influenced me to enter this profession and persuaded me that I could do it to the glory of God rather than as a strike against him. I would highly recommend both of these texts to you all, maybe while you're here. I would recommend Nicolai's book, which is a fascinating didactic comparison of the two worldviews, the spiritual worldview represented by Lewis and the atheistic worldview represented by Freud, two very persuasive proponents of each position. And that's the idea of the book, is to find the best people arguing in the strongest way from both sides. And the book actually turns out to be, I think, a fairly balanced, equivalent presentation of both views. The play is a literary embodied comparison of the same. And the play depicts this imaginary visit by C.S. Lewis to Freud on the eve of England's entry into World War II in September 1939. Hitler has just invaded Poland, and the British Prime Minister addresses his constituents on the radio, and the air raids have begun, and the troops are not being pulled out of Poland, as has been demanded of Hitler. Freud fled Austria and the Nazis, and now he's, this is the true part, now he's built a replica of his Vienna study in London. I don't know if others have been to see Freud's office. Has anybody seen it? Fascinating. I've been there. It's well worth going. You see all these dead gods. And you can't say that Freud had no desire for God. All these dead gods he's collected. What follows in the play is a fascinating tête-à-tête, contrasting the worldviews by putting into each character's mouths some of the sharpest lines from each of these two men. The play poses the question, which man in the end is the patient in need of therapy to see the world more clearly? Freud thinks it's Lewis. Lewis, a bit more politely than Freud, I think, thinks it's Freud. So, in keeping with Nicolai's book, the playwright generally leaves room to see the merits of both worldviews. This is the end here. But at the end of the play, there's a tipping of the scale, I think, in a final reference to music and desire. Throughout the play, the conversation between Lewis and Freud has been repeatedly interrupted by these BBC radio broadcasts, and you hear Chamberlain coming on and announcing, updating the constituents of Britain about Hitler's refusal to remove the troops, and air raids are beginning, and each broadcast ends with music being played, classical music. And each time the music comes on, after the announcement is over, Freud gets up to quickly turn the music off. Lewis challenges him and shares that he loves how music stirs the emotions, stirs desire. Freud says he distrusts how it interferes with rationality. They eventually agree to disagree, and they part ways. And later in the play, after answering Freud's wish-fulfillment critique of Christianity, the one that we've looked at in this talk, after answering that with the argument from desire, which we've also looked at in this talk, Lewis goes on to say this: my idea of God, it constantly changes. He shatters it time and time again. Still, I feel the world is crowded with him. He's everywhere, incognito. And his incognito, it's so hard to penetrate. The real struggle is to keep trying to come awake, and then stay awake. That's the fourth path that this desire can take through our lives. And that statement in the play ushers the audience quickly toward the final scene of the play. Since it's not playing anywhere right now, I think I'm going to spoil it. And in the final scene of the play, and the final slide of my talk, Lewis has just left Freud's office to return to his teaching post at Oxford, where he will soon comfort his nation on wartime radio, the famous radio addresses, and he will write the beloved Chronicles of Narnia. He will write this literary character who perhaps kindles the desire of children and adults for God more than any other character ever has. Freud, who will die in a few weeks, turns on the radio in the final scene of the play to hear another broadcast, and this time leaves the music on. So let us close in kind. Arguments. Yes, please. If you can say your name, please. Peter, yes.
And thank you. One of the students here.
Hey, we're all students, man. We don't need any quotation marks, you know.
a lot to mention, but a few observations that you may be interested in. As you may know, I think this is true of Harvard, this whole idea of transcendence and seeking something greater. I believe it's true that the justice course is still the most popular course at Harvard.
I know it's still running, and I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know the stats on that, yeah. But mm-hmm. I remember sitting in on it and auditing it. I didn't take it, but mm-hmm. I sat in on it, and it evoked desire.
Mm-hmm. And at Yale, it's the happiness course by Lori Santos, a psychologist. And the most popular course at Brown is Beyond Narnia, taught by two medical school faculty.
Is that right?
Yes.
At Brown. No offense to the Brownies in the room.
I just find sort of
interesting
as an observation.
What do you make of it?
I think they're tapping into a felt need, a desire, sort of a sense among the students that this can't be all there is in some ways. Mm. I mean, I was looking at the final slide, at the picture of Jesus holding someone, and it looked as though there were books scattered about, and I'm thinking, is that a graduate student?
Could be books, yeah. Yeah. That's a famous, famous image from late 80s, maybe, or early 90s. I remember when it came out, I think.
But, on something else, this encounter with the beautiful, I don't know how long you've been at Harvard, but were you there during the presidency of Drew Faust?
Yes.
Okay, because she wrote this wonderful book called Republic of Suffering, or This Republic of Suffering, in which she mentions that up until the time of the Civil War, the primary view of heaven was that, even in the United States, was the beatific vision. Hmm. And it was only with the onslaught of death in the United States that it shifted to this kind of lateral view of family reunion. And I thought that I understand that, but it is also sort of, it's a subtle shift from worship of God to worship of the creature rather than the creator.
Maybe it speaks to sort of the first pathway I was talking about, how easily it is to kind of deify the relational objects of desire as close as we can get in this life. Right. So the best we can imagine is just a reunion with each other. Mm-hmm. It's like in, what's that movie, The Cocoon?
And then just one final, well, for now, because I want to open this up, but from a G.K. Chesterton's book, Orthodoxy, the discussion of the maniac, in which he's lost everything but his reason. And as you were talking about the case study, I was thinking about that and how sort of in classical thought, there's the intellectus versus the ratio, where the intellectus is that which apprehends and comprehends sort of the ineffable, whereas the ratio that is more kind of the stuff of life. And I think we are, as people, we're drawn to the ratio because it just makes sense, whereas it's the intellectus which may kind of fall on harder shores, but seems to be that which compels us, you know, to be the poets, the writers, the artists, and it, if you will, to be the psychiatrists that are investigating this. And I just have to ask, are you familiar with the work of Paul Vitz?
Yes, I almost thought about sort of putting that a short list of references in here about people who've written about Freud. Yeah, when I took Nikolai's course, this is my humble brag moment where I get to say I took his course at Harvard. Some of the Vitz book was is it Faith of the Fatherless? I know that's been talked about here. I know before. Yeah, so that I have looked at, and some similar authors as well. Yeah.
So it seems that what you're talking about is. It's not just an interest that there is.
Yeah. Well, I even think about, thank you so much for the observations. I've got a few references to track down now myself. Thanks. But I obviously found myself not quite sure why, but shrinks, sometimes you just follow your associations, right? But Jordan Peterson, I was thinking about just now, and sort of been interested in the incredible appeal that seems to follow him around, and to hear in some of what he says that this profound statement, as you said at the beginning, there's something more, there must be something more, even though it's not a Christian vision, I think, quite yet. Anyway, random association, but what other thoughts, questions do people have? This is dessert after the main course, so the best part. Yeah, and your name?
Aaron,
yeah.
So you talked a lot about the fact that God fulfills desire. How would you explain how that happens or what that looks like? Meaning, like, we have a transcendent desire, but what does it look like to have that fulfilled?
Ooh, I was struggling with the first part of the question because I was thinking, my goodness, how does God fulfill those our desire in
piecemeal, in increments, in fragments, you know, throughout this life, because I believe that he does, and we could all think about how he does that. But the second part of your question was suggested a complete fulfillment of the desire, and there I would have to defer to the pure realm of imagination. I think by the nature of the desire we've talked about, we haven't yet experienced it. So I wouldn't dare to speak to the ultimate way in which the desire may be fulfilled. But I think we get these intimations. I think that, again, Lewis would say, well, it's there in the memory of playing with his brother. And he doesn't even say quite what it is about that memory. It's a curious thing. So, you know, if you go through Lewis's story, there's all these curious things. Another one is the music of Wagner. And, you know, I listen to Wagner a little bit, and, you know, I mean, I can say I sort of appreciate it and like it on some level, but I don't think I quite get the same experience. It's a curiously individualistic thing, I think, this kind of desire, that when we get these sort of pangs of desire that we feel we're in touch with, but we're nowhere close to actually the completion of it. I think that's, again, as a sort of psychological fellow, I think that's a highly individually shaped thing. I can speak very personally about some of the moments where I think that desire has been addressed in my life, but I'm not sure I quite want to go there at the moment. Let's see. There's probably more to say about that, because you're asking how does it happen in this life, and others have thoughts about that. I mean, I can give one example if others have thoughts. I mean, so that song Scarlet, that was the song my wife and I chose to play for our entry after the ceremony of our wedding, for our entry into the reception, you know, the grand entry where you, and then the dance, that was Sigur Rós. But the entry was that song that we just listened to. And for me, that, again, this will have no purchase probably for anyone else, because the nature of this is that it has to speak in such an individualized way so that you feel you're being taken up into it, and that it's a personalized kind of message. So it won't be the same thing for any of us, but that was one of the moments for me, with that music and that woman and that moment and that promise and that imagination of a future and that sense of God being at the center of it in that place with all the people around, you know, that was for me, I think, one of the moments that was, I would say, yes, that was a deep evoking of this desire. But the wedding was over before we knew it. And although we'd sort of vowed to stay close to each other's side, you get torn away and you've got to talk to, you know, great Aunt Bertha for a moment. And, you know, it doesn't take very long for you to realize your feet are on the ground and made of clay, and the thing you thought you were just about to be transported up into evaporates. I think that's the nature of this kind of desire. So I don't know that it's fulfilled in this life, but we get these profound ripples. But what would others say about that? We've got a poet in the midst. Could probably put better words on this. Sarah?
I don't know if this is... It's not an answer to that question.
Oh, darn it! I'm so desirous of an answer. Better answer than I gave.
It's sort of maybe a companion question. I'm just thinking a lot about the role of the imagination in all of this. And, you know, when I think of like how has God fulfilled desires, so much of that happens in the realm of the imagination. It's deeply physical. There's met provision. There's very tangible things that happen that I have hoped for and longed for. But even in, like, I'm thinking of the season when Joshua and I broke up, and everything I hoped for was crumbling, and it felt like I had ruined everything. And but I had some pretty profound encounters, I would say, with God that like gave me visual images of his care for both me and Joshua in that time. Mm. And like I think like, that was a time of God both meeting my longing and meeting me in my longing.
Meeting you in the longing. That has the ring of truth more than the meeting of the longing.
Yeah. So like the God's companionship with us in whatever the circumstances may be. And so I guess my question there is, like our imagination seems to be, I mean, like all of us, like it is fallen, and so we use it to live in all sorts of distorted realities or non-realities. But it also, I think, is something that is redeemed, and like the baptized imagination, I think, is this place of encounter with God, and which I think you're just on that turf, and artists and poets and musicians, like that's the space, I think, that artists like tread in that zone and then stoke that up in us. So I don't know. I guess I'm wondering more about how, as a fellow Christian, as a psychiatrist, how you think about, like, I think at one point you said in distinction real or imagined. Yeah. And I want to say, like, it's not always an either or. Like, sometimes the imagined is an encounter with the most real. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know where that leads you and how you think about that. But,
when you get a question like that, how do you give an adequate answer to the question? Well, I think it makes me associate to Till We Have Faces, another Lewis book, maybe my favorite. I don't know if I can accurately retell the part of it I'd want to make the point with, but maybe I won't try, but just leave it as a cliffhanger to go and read Till We Have Faces. But maybe something closer to my experience and where I think, you know, whatever artistry there can be in psychotherapy, this is where it is for me, and these are the moments where I feel the spirit is walking through the room, and that is a being with me in certain desires that I have. In addition to the moment I told you about, where my patient, I think, was experiencing a reawakening of imagination. Mm-hmm. Because I am struck, when thinking about that case, and she wouldn't mind me talking about this, in thinking about that case, I think she would agree that if I say that the spiritual imagination was dented and deadened and had been killed off, or was dormant, or, you know, one of those other pathways that we can understand how we get to through psychological pathways, developmental courses of early life. And when it wakes up again, I'm just affirming, I guess, the truth you invoke in your question. It's an imaginative reawakening. I think she would say that was a moment of experiencing this kind of desire. I can give another example. Just think about common denominators. Another patient I had, similar in many ways, struggling with some of the same things. Had worked as an escort for many years. Given that up. And went through our program and did an amazing job. And through a party, a very different kind of party than she'd thrown or been at in the past. And through a party for her birthday, and she had all kinds of feelings about throwing herself a party and almost didn't do it. Can relate to that. Mine's next week. and she, it was so conflicted about, you know, telling people, you know, ended up just telling people, She told some people, didn't tell most people she wanted there. You know, she was going to just order some pizza, didn't say why. She was going to have some pizza and just order some, you know, drinks. And, you know, some people might just feel free to come over and eat pizza. The whole story, you know, didn't get shared. And to her utter amazement, and I think to the reawakening of her spiritual imagination, everyone she knew in Boston came to that. And she told me, much like my first patient, in tears about this in a session 2 days later. And I don't remember the exact words, but the message was, I didn't imagine this was possible for me, and that there would be this kind of love in the world. And as she kept talking about it through tears, completely spontaneously, of her own accord, without any explicit suggestion for me of anything religious, she said, I don't know why, but I find myself thinking about the God I believed in when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And went on from that to talk about tears. You know, I don't know why I stopped believing. This has to be something of God, because I never thought it was possible. It's bigger than me. You know, so, and look, you know, if we bring Sam Harris to talk at Labrie, he will be completely unpersuaded mm-hmm. by the stories that I'm telling. Mm-hmm. Because there are these persuasive counter-arguments to understanding these experiences that way. Mm-hmm. And we have to contend with that, and I think Sam Harris is brilliant. I wouldn't want to be in a debate with him. So I watch him in other debates with other people that are smarter than me. But so where's the preponderance of evidence? What do you do with a story like that? Mm-hmm. As someone who wants to be an artist in my own way, but no way like you. But these are the moments where I feel God is doing the artistry in the lives of the people that I have the privilege of sitting with. And it also, strangely, those are the moments where I'm most clearly convinced it's not me doing this work. I'm out of the way, I'm most disembodied and most embodied at the same time. And that's a reawakening of my spiritual imagination, my desire for my work to mean something. I think it to really mean something, and to not just be about my own ego, which I have plenty of. Bendel. thank you. You can just say you're welcome for introducing that at the brief.
Thanks a lot.
But no.
So much of this conversation is really, I suppose, in a sense you framed it as the existence of God is sort of on the table here, and the real presence of desire that seems to be reaching for, longing for God's transcendent reality is an indication that he's really there. And then the critique of that, well, that's just wish fulfillment. And I think that's you know, appropriately the basis for Lewis's arguments. He's observing desires in himself and in people, and then trying to show that they actually correspond to things that are real, even though you cannot see them, and it's not a proof in that sense. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the most persuasive arguments, and you've touched on it, I think, against belief in God as just wish fulfillment, is that if you actually do respond to that desire and try to seek the real God who's actually there, it becomes painfully clear that he does not exist to fulfill your desires. You know, your desires are indications about the existence of such a God, maybe, but he's not. If we keep the whole conversation on the ground that it's on now, you could get the impression that God is there just so that all these bizarre, unfulfilled, deep yearnings are met, and that's why he's there. And so often, you know, we find, you know, Lewis said we experience a dismay. You know, it may be the dismay that actually I'm in need of forgiveness, and I don't really want to admit that, and I need to admit my life is wrong. You know, this Or it may be like, actually, I'm called to a life of obedience, of submitting to something that's really outside of my head. It's really outside of my desires.
To not make a god of my own subjective experience.
The god wants me to do this thing that actually doesn't particularly fulfill my desires at all. In fact, it makes...
Right.
But it's real. And it's true. And so I think that... you know, just the dismissive sort of like its wish fulfillment doesn't take into account what actually following this Lord looks like. You know, think of all the language in the New Testament about glory, you know, like Lewis talks about, but also about dying to yourself, picking up your cross. He's so clearly a Lord that's not a product of my brain, you know, in terms of what I most want. I'm just creating something to fulfill that want. That's to me that, you know, the even more evidence that points up, this is true. The desires that I should have and that are right and good are fulfilled and met. But I may have to confront all kinds of other ones in light of who he is. So I guess the more particular you get about what the Christian life actually looks like, the more just out of place the wish fulfillment argument looks. It's it's not.
The infinite regress counter-argument to that would be, which you didn't ask for, but would be
please, give it to me.
I think the Sam Harris point might be, well, look, we have all these other reasons to believe that it's just your mind and brain that's doing this. Mm-hmm. So we can tell a complicated enough story about why you're motivated to construct the following of the desire in this partially unsatisfying way that you have just so poignantly touched on. But as a Christian, and someone sort of trying to walk that same path, what you say cuts like orc steel. Because it has the ring of truth. Mm. Like, that's it. You just described it. As soon as you... That's, again, Lewis, it's not, I don't think this is there so much in Lewis, but, well, it's not as explicitly laid out as you just did, but it's in the sort of... you get close to it, and then it evaporates. But it's in what happens next after that. That's such an interesting thing you're spotlighting, that what happens next in the Christian life doesn't... You know, what happens next for the woman who has the people come to her party, it's not so much that moment, because you could just say, well, she always wanted people to come to her party. That's just the perfect fulfillment of the thing she always longed for, didn't know she wanted. But it's what happens next then with that woman, and what is she called into? And you're right, it's usually something we're called into that's not just about trading out old desires for new ones. It's not like a one-to-one correlation. I'll just get rid of this sort of corrupt, deified desire, and God will immediately replace it with one that's equally or more fulfilled. It's not a matter of like balancing the desire, you know, books, the balance. Always left wanting more.
This is where language of hunger and thirsting in the Bible is so interesting, because to me it's like an experience of lack. Like you're talking about hunger and thirst for the Lord, and yet it's also sort of a description of spiritual health. You know, if you're not hungering and thirsting for God, you're wasting away. You just don't know it.
Right.
But if you're hungering and thirsting for God, you're longing for the right person.
Yeah.
It's just you feel his distance, and that as a description of what spiritual health actually is, even though it's a picture of like wasting away in a sense.
You have some, just like in human relationships, you have some internalized image of the person which is either secure or insecure, and we hold on to that when we're separated from our loved ones, and we call it to mind when we want to feel comforted even after they've gone. But it's sorely lacking. We want it to be real and go on.
It made me think of a thing that meant a lot to me. Somehow in Mark, Mark's Gospel, where he tells the story of Jesus, they're in the boat and there's a big sea and high wind and so on, and he's sound asleep in the stern of the boat. And the disciples are all terrified, we're going to drown. Just this guy. You're going to sleep through this? You're going to wake up and help me? Because we're afraid of drowning. He then stands up, stops the wind and the water, flattens the water. And then it says, they were afraid. Then they feared with a very great fear. The Greek is megaphobia. Mm-hmm. After he had saved them from death. Mm-hmm. They were only afraid of dying first. And then they found they're in the same boat.
That's right.
With someone who could speak and stop the whole
thing. More afraid. Not desire quenched, but yeah. More afraid.
So it's not just that Jesus, as you come to him, has things in his plan for you that are scary, yeah. Mm-hmm. But he himself,
yes.
And the presence of an infinite God in the same boat right there, is something that is not the God of wish fulfillment.
Yeah,
it's not the God you want for comfort, yes. And for daddy, yes. Who, if you didn't have a daddy who was helpful, whatever. This isn't the one that shows up.
Back to Till We Have Faces. Now you've just triggered my memory. That's Orwell at the end of the story. Mm-hmm. Probably my favorite piece of Lewis's writing anywhere, where it confronts the gods. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she all throughout the story she said, well, if I could just, you know, get a chance to say what I want to say to those gods. And she's envious of this sister who's been beloved by Cupid and whisked away to the mountain and gotten everything that Orwell wanted, right, from getting the characters right. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the story, brought face to face with the gods. Mm-hmm. And has this same moment like the boat that you just described. You know, the real thing itself, the real object of the desire, she's reduced to fear and shame and realizes if all this time, basically, this great soliloquy, I can't remember it, but all this time I thought if I just had the chance to say what was in my heart to the gods, if I could have my hearing, I think she says. Mm-hmm. But she says, now that the hearing is laid out and the complaint is made, essentially it's a Job moment. I fall on my face and realize the things in my heart are not adequate to meet you face to face.
No, he's saying.
Awe. So is that, that's hard for Freud or Sam Harris, I think, to say, that's a perfect, simple fulfillment of any obvious human desire.
How many people want that?
We tremble at that, right? Yeah. It begins in dismay. Mm-hmm. The real confrontation with the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had another different angle that struck me, because I, in my search for God, becoming a Christian in my early 20s, there was nothing like Lewis's sort of sense of beauty or sense of wonder or something like this. It was much more, is there any meaning to this story of life or not? Mm-hmm. And Lewis develops that in American Christianity very much more. Is there a moral order there? Mm-hmm. But somehow what, as I look back on it, what took me forward was very believable experiences that a meaningless world is really implausible. Mm. It's not so much experiences of God, but experiences of somehow, if what I see in front of me, if what I experience has no meaning, that is just very unbelievable. The meaning was beating out. Mm-hmm. Negative meaning sometimes, terrific tragedy, that was just nothing. That was somehow very, very weak.
So the beautyless world was untenable.
And the goodness, the rightness world was just so implausible somehow.
Interesting.
I never could quite get as high as he got in his early searches even.
Yeah. I'm not sure any of us ascend to his heights. Was there a question or thought in the back somewhere?
Yeah,
and I forgot your name, I'm sorry. Peter, that's right, of course.
I've seen of the second case study you were mentioning, the birthday party. One of the things I was thinking about is, what would a conversation with one of the guests have been like? Why is it that they came? What is it that they saw? What was it that they felt the need to do this?
Because
I'm thinking in our own lives, we can be so busy and kind of fragmented that invitation to come to us, and we say, well, I'm sorry, you know, I'd love to, but, and I'm just wondering, you know, what is it that
I can amazingly answer this somewhat, actually, because I, you know, we one of the hats that I wear, we have a residential program, and so some of our people are in treatment together, and so we work with multiple people at the same time, so I actually can answer for one person at least, and I think this might have been in the hearts of some others who were eager to go when they learned that she was having a birthday. And this is a little long, see if you can follow me here, I'll try to make it coherent, but what many people around this person said, looking at her from the outside, is she doesn't know her worth. She doesn't know how good, beautiful she is. Now, we weren't. This wasn't about kind of delving deeply into the like Christian doctrine of sin, like actually confrontation with ugliness. She had the sort of a sense of a kind of her own ugliness and pathology and sinfulness. I mean, she had plenty of that. The side that was much harder to connect to in any believable, authentic way was what she had to offer. Mm-hmm. And so I think one reason, and I know one reason, some people flocked to be with her that night and stay long and really celebrate her, was that they felt they saw through both sides and wanted, through their mirroring of her goodness, as it were, to sacramentally, concretely, you know, in an embodied way, convey, we're here because we see this other side of you, the beauty that you're capable of. Well, where am I going with this? Well, what this person, you know, wanted more than anything, I think this is one of her desires that fits this talk, is she would say to be known. You know, and she had people that had known her in a partial way, in a way that she experienced ultimately as debasing, debased. Mm-hmm. That was a kind of knowledge. Then there were more recent people that had known her, that you know, kind of knew the recent her, but that she felt she couldn't know about what she'd done. She couldn't, had to hide it, couldn't tell them. If this information got out, then it would be the end of whatever friendship or love relationship she had with these newer people in her life. She wanted to be known for all of it. And these people who came to the parties, they'd been in treatment together, and they had a sense that they actually did have contact with all these sides of her. So anyway, that's just to say, I think that actually, again, maybe we can intertwine this back with the point, Sarah's point that got me telling that story, and that the reawakening of an imagination for her, the possibility that somewhere out there in the world, in some condition, not perfectly in any human sense, but somewhere, she could be more fully known. And I think that was something we ended up talking about a fair amount after that. You know, that she, and again, it's like my wedding. You know, you're immediately taken out of it and whisked back to reality with all its imperfections. You know, well, and she, you know, she even later would question that experience. Well, maybe people weren't really there for me. But, you know, they heard there was some free drinks and free pizza. And, you know, the way we all doubt these kind of things. But that moment of the reawakening of the imaginative possibility, that stayed with her. And she did start to, I think, chase after God or allow herself to be chased in a fresh way. That was constant. The possibility, I think that's the Lewisian desire, the sense that it must be, it's not here in you or you or you, but it feels like it's out there somewhere, and I really hope it's true. Yeah, in the back. Yeah, what's your name?
Hi, my name is Emily.
Emily, hi.
I've really enjoyed your lecture. Thank you so much for all of this. Something I've been thinking about throughout is the role of like brain biology and neurobiology and how that can affect desires. So
yes,
I actually work at McLean Research.
Did you
really? Folks who have experienced like trauma or kind of PTSD research lab. And
oh, wow. You want to switch places.
No, definitely not. But I'm just thinking, like, some people might have experiences of clinical depression where they're not experiencing desire and anhedonia.
Yes.
I also think about the role of, like, stress hormones and CRF and how that can hijack your desire for desire.
Yep.
And then even in the realms of, like, cosmetic psychiatry and trying to, like, optimize our desire. So
yeah.
I guess, what do you think the role of neurobiology or neuroscience is, like, in this conversation, how we think about desire?
Oh, my gosh. What a good question. Again, I don't think I could do it justice except to just say I try to think about that a lot. Because I think on the one hand, God can break through anything biological, any biological limitation. We see that in the Gospels. Water into wine. We see dead people coming back to life. We see transfiguration. We see so many examples that defy, you know, everything that we think we know about how the brain and biological substrates work. So on the one hand, if we're Christians, we have to affirm that. On the other hand, we at the same time, we have to fully affirm that these, all of our psychological experiences, not just spiritual experiences, and not just this particular thing we're calling the spiritual experience of desire, all of our psychological experiences are transmuted, they're transceived, to some degree, through our biology. Mm-hmm. So, in the case of dementia, we know as biology changes, aspects of a person's spirituality and experience of God do change. I think not all of it, but some aspects I think really do. You see more through a glass darkly on different points in our lives, and sometimes that darkening is because of biology. God doesn't protect us from that. Not even Jesus was protected from his closeness with the Father being taken away, right? So I think for people struggling with depression, or for my patients struggling with just this core self-loathing and self-doubt and suicidality, that I go to Jesus in Gethsemane a lot for thinking about just this. Somehow, whether that was a biological thing going on or some cosmic spiritual thing going on, it happened even to him, so that there's at some point there is he experienced limitations. And anyway, so I'm meandering, but bottom line is, yes, in my work with people, I think I try to do the best that I can to prescribe medications that may be helpful biologically. We have to do all of that, just like we would treat cancer with anti-cancer agents. I'm basically just affirming again what I think I hear in your question, is that we've got to think biologically, but to not think reductionistically. Mm-hmm. So biological factors are relevant. Ultimately, we believe in a Lord over biology who created our biological fallenness and supervenes on it, superintends over it. Mm-hmm. That is a mystery. But as a clinician, I try to do justice to both sides. And we think hard about what we prescribe and what we don't prescribe, and when someone might benefit from electroconvulsive therapy or transcranial magnetic stimulation. We do all of that. We do exposure therapy. We do behavioral therapies. We do all of this. And as a Christian, I'm, on a good day at least, I'm just trying to be open to where God might be in all of it. Mm-hmm. On the waves, in the neurotransmitters, in the antidepressants, you can use anything, even you and me. Not much of an answer. Mm-hmm. It's a riffing question. You can only have one, Sarah.
Do I have a little bit?
One and a half for you? Please, yeah. I'll stay all night. You probably wouldn't want that.
I'm just thinking, in part because find what Jesus says in John 7 that you have there, a beautiful and puzzling statement. You know, come to me, anyone who thirsts. Mm. And then from out of his heart will flow rivers of living water.
Oof.
So it's like, and John then says, he said this to speak about the Holy Spirit, the anticipating Holy Spirit. And so, something I've thought about, or I guess just recognizing myself as like, oh, I assume that at some point I won't be thirsty. I'll stop thirsting. I'll drink enough, and I won't be thirsty anymore. Right. And if I'm still thirsty, it's a deficiency in me. And I guess, so like, I keep coming back to this and thinking like, maybe Jesus uses this thirst metaphor and image because biologically, it never goes away.
Yes.
Like, we always thirst. We always have to come back to him. And he gives us the Holy Spirit to keep meeting that thirst.
Yes.
And
to be with us in the thirst.
To be with us in the thirst. And to, and maybe that's another, or that is another expression of that song. Delight yourself in the Lord, teach you the desires of your heart, which is both, I think, a meeting and a kindling of desires. And maybe this goes back to, was it Aaron's question, like, how does God meet these desires? How is desire met? And it seems like he meets it by giving Holy Spirit. he gives himself, he does everything to give himself to us. Sorry, kind of question.
Welcome every layer of that comment. I have nothing to add.